Interstate Batteries has been a proud supporter of the Sportsman's Nation since day one. They offer just about every battery under the sun, from car and truck batteries to batteries for your trail cameras and rangefinders. Select retail locations even offer cell phone repair and cracked screen repair. Find a local retail location at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
All right, there we go. I felt like the whole podcast was interesting, and it's just like one more piece. Every single time we talk to these researchers, it's just like we get confirmation on things that we already thought or conversations we've already had, but it also just makes it go, okay, well, that makes sense. And it just is, it's frustrating to me how, you know, it's 2021, and we're getting, now the research is coming out, it's just like confirming all this stuff that many of us have been preaching for several years about. This is the way we need to manage land. But yet it still feels like new information to people. And when we share it, or they share it, or we share it together in different audiences or different seminars or whatever, it's like people are hearing it for the first time, and it's thinking, how does this happen? How have we reached this point? And I think much of that is to our fault, to others' fault, of when the people's ear was held by people who didn't follow the research.
Correct.
And by that I mean the people who were getting the information to the land owners were sharing stuff that wasn't research based. It was opinion based or product based, or they just didn't know any better. Ignorance was the thing.
Yeah.
And now I feel like the researchers are keying in on doing research that is now being more directly applying to landowners. It can be directly applied to private landowners, public landowners. The problem is, in my opinion, that much of the people have almost shut off some of the researchers because they feel like it's too over the head a lot. Like the delivery of the research is either too in-depth, or they're already just feel like they're sitting in a classroom and they hated it anyway, like me.
I think everyone wants to have a short answer.
Yeah,
of what does this mean? I appreciate all the hard work that went into the research, but at the end of the day, give me the Cliff Notes version, essentially. I think
that's right.
It's a little bit why there could be a disconnect there, but I think this is, you know, it takes all kinds. It takes people to be devoted to good science, figuring out, finding good science and learning this stuff. But then it takes other individuals to be able to communicate it
well
and apply it.
Absolutely.
To
and I feel like,
life.
You know, when we, there's a lot of research that we follow, a lot of researchers out there, professors that are doing incredible research. And I feel like what we do well is take their information, not because they can't do it, but they may not want to break it down and deliver it and come back with all the questions of like, oh, here's the information, just take it or leave it. Or,
right.
That's where I feel like one of the guys, and maybe he won't mind me saying this, but I feel like when I talk to him about it, it's just like, here's the information, just take it. This is the truth, and you may not want all the follow back in those questions. That's Dr. Craig Harper. Every time we talk to him about stuff, like if we start going in depth and asking, it's just like, there's the information, man.
Yeah.
Just take it.
But I think, you know, it's, all of it comes back and stems from, we want to make the best and biggest impact. And here are all the things that we can do. And that's why I like the collaboration and working with these skilled professors and their graduate students to figure out, man, here's the latest in the science.
Yeah.
And so if we take the latest in the science and apply it to all the other knowledge that we've learned, we're then ahead of the game. or exactly. we can make some changes or tweaks. I'm not going to say any of this is like crazy earth shattering changes. No. It's expected,
yeah.
But it's good to have that confirmation. And I think that for everyone listening, it's good for you guys to hear that reiteration of, now, what you're seeing, what you've observed, and maybe what you've thought, or maybe what you've heard us, you know, speculate, is confirmed through this research. And so mm-hmm. that means yep. that we need to take that intensity yep. of management farther. We need to take it to another level, and continue to again diversify. And if anyone hasn't picked up already, what we're gonna do in this podcast is basically just go back through and reiterate, I think you used the term unpack, all that great information that Dr. Marcus Lashley was talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
And covered in the podcast, because there's a lot there. But what we don't want to do is skip over all that good information and really tell you guys exactly how it applies to you and your farm.
That's right. We should have done this in the past when we had others on.
Will Goolsby and some of the guys at biologists at QDMA, and
when we had Mike Chamberlain, Brett yeah. Collier on.
Yep.
I was thinking about that the other day. It's like there's certain professors, researchers that I really like. They're like to me like I follow them, and their work and the latest research that they're doing, and then see if what they're doing applies to me or can apply to me.
Sure.
And
or apply to our clients in this region yeah. or whatever.
Yeah. For like, I mean, when it comes to turkeys, Mike Chamberlain, Brett Collier, when it comes to deer, you know, there's several people, Craig Harper,
Bronson Strickland,
even Kip Adams, when mm-hmm. his, some mm-hmm. of the stuff they've done or supported in research, Pennsylvania, I'm not sure the professor up there, but
Dr.
Penn
Allen.
State.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It's a long, unique name.
Yeah. And,
props to you, whoever you are.
Yeah. and of course, Marcus Lashley, Bronson Strickland, Steve Damaris, who else have we had? Will Goolsby, Craig Harper,
yep.
all those guys. That's kind of in a nutshell, and I'm sure there's others, and in the future we're going to have on that may not be wildlife specific. But, for us, that's kind of a good rundown of some of the latest, the people that we like to follow. When it came to this topic, it was like there's nothing really – I mean, there is earth-shattering stuff here, but the biggest thing is when we're interviewing – a professor, researcher, and they're giving us we're just trying to get the information. And then it's like, we need to take the time to then take that information through our questions and their research, and then how does this apply?
Mm-hmm.
How does this, me as a landowner, if my place is upland forest, how does this apply? If my place is swamp bottom ground, how does this apply? What can I do with this information? It's like many times I find myself buying a new whatever it may be, like mm-hmm. a pressure washer. That was something I had in the past month. Bought a pressure washer. Not a phenomenal time to buy a pressure washer, but yeah. on sale. So there you go.
Sure.
And I remember I was putting it together. It was just like, I don't care. Just tell me where this piece goes.
Yeah.
And that's where
you got irritated at directions?
Yes. It's like, it's telling
me
like,
that.
just tell me where it goes.
Yeah.
And because I have to read through 5 pages of warnings.
And you don't want to know more than what you need to know because it's a pressure washer. I just want to use it.
Yeah.
And I think that's another part of where a lot of landowners fall into is, listen, I'm a professional in another field and I want to know this for my sake, and
yeah.
I don't need to know anything more. Just break it down, boil it down, tell me what I need to know, and I'm moving on, and I'll apply it. I'll do it,
mm-hmm.
but just don't give me all the other stuff.
Yeah. It's like with a chainsaw.
Get to
how often should I sharpen it?
Yeah.
How often should I change
well, when
the
it gets
filter?
Dull.
Yeah. How often should I store it with fuel? How much fuel?
Yeah.
What should I do to winterize it? And
how long can I let my fuel sit without being utilized?
What kind of mix?
Yep.
And what kind of
what
oil?
Ratio?
And that's it.
Yeah.
Like, and it's just like don't give me all the fluff.
Yep.
And I feel like that's where this research sometimes we can get lost in the weeds because it sounds great
and it's awesome information, but how does that apply to me? For example, I mean, we are coming up in trapping season, and it seems like we're, you know, getting questions. I've had some guys hit me up about what traps to buy and different things. And it's like, there's all kinds of research on trapping, but it's like, what? How does that apply to me? Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but many of it doesn't, because a lot of the research is not achievable for you,
scalable
private landowner.
Yeah.
When they're trapping almost year-round on thousands and thousands of acres, and they're targeting all these species, it does not apply to you. Don't think that it does.
Right, right.
And, I mean, there's so much research out there.
You
have to
that.
You have to figure out which ones you can replicate, which ones for you, and yeah. Which ones you just say, interesting, and move on.
Yep.
And don't apply it, because it's not applicable.
Yep.
And so, yeah, that's what this week's
so
unpacking is.
Let's unpack it. Let's go into essentially the first study that he talked about that Mariah had conducted, and what does that mean? Basically, when they collected the 75,000 acorns and placed them under the trees and looked for preference in a year that had low mass production, here was an abundance of mass not being consumed.
Yeah,
like as soon as it was available. What does that tell us? What does that mean for those
what
managing
did you
those
take
species?
Away? What was the biggest thing that you took away? Like, if I were to ask you, what are two main points that in that conversation that you were like, that comes to mind?
Honestly, it didn't have anything to do with oaks. It had everything to do with deer and foraging.
Okay.
So basically, some of my takeaways was, I didn't really care about the species under the umbrella of red and under the umbrella of white oaks, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, let's just get that down. But then here's this abundance of food that we know deer are going to eat. They eat red oak acorns across the country. Where they're available, they eat them.
Yep.
But the deer intentionally avoided or left, saved, I'm air quoting that because they don't have the capacity to think that necessarily, but they didn't utilize that forage base, although it was present, until it was necessary. It's like their body is in such close, let's say, syncing with the land and the climate, the region that they're in, that they knew that that resource was going to be better utilized later in the winter when other food sources weren't going to be.
Yeah.
That's what I took from that. These deer are foraging on something, obviously, outside of the mass production because they're not eating it right now. They're going to come to it later on, and I think that was the biggest takeaway is I think sometimes we're just trying to hunt, well, there's – look at all these acorns, they're on the ground.
Yeah.
Maybe they're going to come in there, or maybe they're going to wait. I mean, the viability of a food source from a red oak is when it drops in October, November time frame, even December, and it's viable all the way till spring, that's an amazing food source. And I think that, I guess one other takeaway is, okay, that's the foraging behavior and habits of deer. That's cool. But the other one is the implication, I think, that or the love that needs to be shown towards red oaks over a white oak.
That was kind of my main point that I took away was...
That's something we had talked about
a lot
beforehand.
Exactly. We talked about what for you guys that don't know or didn't understand exactly what Matt and I were talking about there was the biggest takeaway for me was how often you hear people say white oaks are their favorite.
Yeah.
There's so much about that statement that's wrong and incorrect because is true in that is that
whose favorite? The deer's favorite?
The deer's favorite.
Okay.
The deer's
favorite. All
right. Deer like white oaks better. And it is like,
that's the statement.
Do they like them better as a whole, or do they like them better right now? And do they like them better right now? And by that I mean early October.
Yep.
Let's just say, you know, when most white oaks are falling, deer are eating them. So early October, I think late September, early October, something along those lines, mid-October. And you can say deer like them best now. And by that, I mean during that time frame, late September, early October. or do they like them best right now because they know that late November they won't be available? Well, so they know they have to eat them right now because they're going to be spoiled in no time.
In a matter of weeks, days.
I don't think we're ever – we can't dissect that.
Well, I think that we just have to look at the foraging behavior and the characteristic of that forage itself. It's not going to be good in a month and a half. So deer know that. I'm sure they've eaten a mealy, rotten, wormy-holed, moist acorn
or one that's
been sprouted. And they're like, good night, that's horrible.
Yeah.
But they knew what it was when it dropped. Yeah. And they're like, well, it's way better then, so I'm not going to – like, that's just learned behavior.
Or they sense it. Like, you know, a lot of times you can watch a deer forage on blackberry, smelling. And they're going to select certain leaves over others.
Sure.
And I feel like that's probably what they do with acorns is they can select, that one's – something's off on that one. I'm going to eat this one. And they can realize that if we let these lay on the ground very long – I mean, we've said it before in the past of like, hey, you know – this October has been a very wet October and very warm. White oak acorns are sprouting a lot earlier this year than they do in the past. So, therefore, I know that white oaks are spoiled. We're waiting on red oaks to rain more.
Yes.
And what I noticed I'll paint a very broad brush, but red oaks drop later. Like, I say that because, like, I can think of a couple trail cameras we have on food plot edges where I think of the north bottom. There's a red oak right along the fence that drops a little later, and it's just like now. I mean, right. November, December is when they're eating those acorns.
Mm-hmm.
Or one here in my subdivision where my daughter and I walk, and every time we get by it, she asks to pick up an acorn.
Yep.
And it's always like last year it was around Christmas that we were picking them up because they just held so long.
Right, right.
But white oaks, they're done for. You don't see a white oak holding on late into the fall.
To me, it's like a feast or famine mode from a white oak standpoint. It's like you either got them or you don't. And when you do have them, you better feast them because they're going to be gone, and they're not going to last long. And to me, from an implication of a forage itself and from a potential space that a tree, a large mass-producing white oak tree, can take up and hold on a property, I mean, I'm envisioning Elam Ridge right now, right? We got 35 acres. So much is timber, and I don't want necessarily the majority of the trees to be white oak species. That is its place is to shine for 3 weeks out of an entire year, every couple years. That's not good. Luckily, that's not the case. I don't have a ton of white oaks. I have three times the amount of northern red oaks and black oaks on the place. And I'm sitting there from a mixture standpoint. If I have timber, that's what I want, because yes, is that food source good? Can I focus in on it when it's available? Yeah, I can. Mm-hmm. There's a dozen trees, but
I think you could consider the slope of your farm and why you have no more red oak family species than you have white oaks. Like if you were a landowner in the Ozarks, like in between our farms, and you had a farm that was mainly south facing slope, you'd probably want more white oaks because you'd want something that could handle fire a little better than the red oak family. And so once again, I mean, you can always find glass half full
for sure
when you look around and say, okay, well, there's a reason, you know. But yeah, for your farm, the red oaks, that should be that's why we say pin us in a corner, and we're probably going to say we like red oaks better.
Yeah, I'm just going to basically straight boiling all the fluff away.
Yeah.
Here's the takeaway. The food source is available longer.
Yeah.
So if I can supplement, whether it's food plot or I can supplement with woody browse, I know through the more stressful time of the year, a winter stress period in this region, I have more food available on good mass production years.
Yep.
That's what I want. That's what I care more about than a food availability in late September, October.
Exactly.
Like,
yes.
It's not we're comparing apples and oranges when we're talking about time frames and what the foraging behaviors are and what the actual, let's say, dietary requirements are for that deer.
And so if you're thinking about a stressful period of time, let's just say January to March, and, you know, white oaks are spoiled for the most part at that point. Most of the food plots are cover crops have been hammered pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Food is pretty sparse. So if you don't have a red oak base and a woody browse base,
what you got?
What are they going to eat?
Well, I think of a lot of a lot of places that don't have woody browse available.
Yeah.
And let's say post-rut, the rut was great, but then the farm is just dead. I mean, just dead. If it's closed canopy, even if there are red oaks in there, maybe it's just unproductive trees because it's overstocked. And so the forage base is limited during that time of the year. That farm is just dead. Deer move off. They find the food. They find the resources that are available. And that's going to be a farm that's got a better balance of woody browse and a red oak base mass crop.
Yeah. And I think of, like, you know, how does this apply to me? What about this applies to me? And we talked about this with him, I think. We talked to him about pollination. You asked him about that, right?
That was after.
Okay. Yep. And so we were talking about pollination and going back to some of the research Dr. Craig Harper did where it was fertilizing trees for 10 years versus thinning around and releasing these oaks in this 10-year study. And then it was vastly more productive to
25% more mast increase, I think it was.
And zero increase with fertilizing.
Right.
And so it was like, okay, how does this apply to me then in regards to if this is where we're drawing lines and we're going to make assumptions. If that is true, because I think it was white oaks that they focused on in that study? Okay. Let's just say it's true for red oaks as well.
Extrapolated over for red oaks.
Okay. And we say, okay, my north slopes and east slopes and lower sites where red oaks are abundant, black and northern reds, because that's mainly what we have here.
Yep.
Let's do some thinning around them. So let's thin the hackberries, the elms, the sycamores, the overstocked red oaks, the overstocked black oaks, the unhealthy-looking ones, and that don't have great crowns, that are mid-canopy, that are trying to grow out from under it. Let's thin that and make those trees more productive.
Yep.
But then, because they're more productive, they're producing more acorns, there's also more sunlight coming down, so we have more herbaceous plant, more oak regeneration. And
you
all of a
probably
sudden,
turned those trees that you did cut down into woody browse opportunities.
Yep.
So there's another great forage base and cover base.
So I've got
forage there.
from the trees I cut down. I've got sunlight hitting the ground. So now I have summer forage with herbaceous plants. I have more sunlight, so I have some grasses for good cover.
Brambles.
But then I have the trees that I left producing more hard mass. So now I've got that added through the winter period. And just like that, I've taken that research and I've gone, okay, this applies directly to me. This is how I use it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And not to say that because I'm doing this work in these red oaks that now I've got a phenomenal hunting spot because it's going to be dropping acorns in November and they're going to be in there. They may be on certain years or certain trees because of the species. But ultimately, I'm just helping lower that stress period during that late winter, early spring.
And that's what I think some of the people get, I don't want to say frustrated with, like, research is, guys, not everything that research is going to show is going to improve a hunting strategy.
No.
I think it's foolish to sit here and expect that everything that we do is going to improve an overall hunting strategy. This is not going to necessarily make you kill a big buck. It could help. But that's not the point of it. The point of it is to be the best land manager. And at the end of the day, if you're the best land manager, you have the best and healthiest specimens to chase. And you can hunt them however you choose to. I don't care if it's spot and stalk. I don't care if it's from a tree stand or a tree saddle.
Because there's
They have to be there first to hunt them.
Yeah.
So stop trying to think of it just as a strategy.
And then if you pack in you find in that TSI, you find a spot. You know what? There's really, this little acre here, there's really nothing of any value. Clear cut it. Cut the whole thing down. Now you got a bedding area. Now hunt the downwind side of that, depending on if it's close to an access. There's baby number one awake.
Hey, girly.
Staring out the window, smiling from ear to ear. And so, you know, that was one of the big takeaways for me was the over What's the word I'm looking for? The almost like, no, I was going to say the pedestal that we put White Oaks on. Now, I love White Oaks. Like, I can't say that I don't like them.
I'm not here to crush them. I'm just here to balance the scale back out and show the fact that there is way more importance of a red oak species than previously given or previously thought from a lot of folks in the hunting community.
That's right. Yeah. When it comes to, like, people planting white oaks, whatever, I mean, you know, don't hate on red oaks. Don't not show love to red oaks, because red oaks are ultimately, probably for a lot of guys, a bigger influence on the deer herd than your white oaks are. The only reason we think white oaks are doing it is because it's more compacted into a 2 to 3 week period.
Absolutely.
And all the deer are going crazy over it.
You think
the deer love that more. Well, maybe they love it just because they don't last as long.
Well, and I think a lot more people hunt during that time frame as seasons open during archery than they do in December when they're pounding red oaks.
Yeah.
And we've specifically killed a deer in December hunting over black oaks on a specific ridge. It's like, well, they're dropping now. That's the food source.
Yep, there you go. But you know, it's a lonely hunt to hunt acorns in December and January.
Yes, sir, it is.
It is cold. It can be cold, and it can be
widespread.
Widespread. Like, just because much of the Ozarks, for us, what we hunt a lot, is big timber. And so between here, there, and over the ridge, there's red oaks scattered amongst it. So it's hard to key in on those like it is with white oaks.
But if you have known bedding areas on the south-facing slopes, you find the shortest point from A to B, and now we could start changing that game with
that
more habitat management. But, yeah, that's my big takeaway, too. You know, the second study I thought was really good when they discussed the different species.
Yeah.
But what was just interesting,
I think... different species, all in the red oak family, because white oaks did not store in the fridge.
Yeah, but...
They were sprouting.
When they used the fire to char and burn the leaves, and it altered the forage base... And this is just me, I'm speculating here, but I think that he, agreed with it.
Yeah.
It made that acorn less viable for a longer period of time. So they hammered it. They got it quick.
Yeah.
Foraged when it was available, just like they do with the white oak. So if that's the whole purpose or what was shown in that study, the second study, well, then with a red oak in certain locations, we can burn at different times and simulate that intensity that is seen in and around white oaks when they drop, how they drop, because it's a short... viable time frame. But we can do the same thing in a known given area. Talk about burning and doing that around a 50-yard stand.
Let me play devil's advocate in here.
No, not welcome.
with that discussion, and I thought about this later after we've had a few, you know, we just went through Thanksgiving. We recorded 2 days before Thanksgiving.
Something like that, yeah.
And now we're a couple days removed. The thing about it to me that when I think about that and playing devil's advocate is like, I don't know that I would necessarily want to burn a 200-acre unit or a 100-acre unit, because I could ultimately then cause all those acorns on that ridge to spoil if
totally.
The deer couldn't consume.
Well, that's why I was like,
so
a 50-yard
fall
spot.
Burning. That's where the bow range burning that I think they did that late summer. Okay, yes.
That was late summer, like right
to get the sprouting.
More forage, right, exactly. More broadleaf, more re-sprouts from that standpoint. But why can't, as acorns are dropping in late October, November timeframe, why can't we take that bow range burning, apply that same science, change the chemistry of the acorn, the mass production, and basically replicate that intense foraging in that area in a very set location.
Yeah.
You know, again, this where you're hunting at. I would not do that in a 200-acre unit and think that I'm doing benefit from a mass production
standpoint. And that's where more is not always best.
Absolutely.
Because you're like, oh, well, I'm going to burn and make this whole hillside attractive. You're ultimately going to lose some acorns because – and then this whole hillside is going to be barren.
Barren after that point.
Yeah.
Not good.
And that's why I think, okay, if you do that in conjunction – you know, there's a lot of great research that they've done at Mississippi State and now that he's doing at Florida University or University of Florida. Excuse me for
be
you
careful
people
because
down there.
There's a bunch of different colleges down there.
Well, it's just like Texas University or University
Texas
of Texas.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You cannot say it wrong, and I said it wrong just in that I don't know which one I said bad
because
I don't really care.
Some
I'm not
school
into
out of
it,
Texas.
But his work down at University of Florida.
Yeah.
Or Florida University.
You said it, not me.
So anyway.
I don't even know what you said.
If you combine that, like, I think about it. It's bow range burning. Okay, we're burning and we're going to attract these. I don't think it would work, or maybe it wouldn't be as attractive with white oaks because they're already attractive enough.
I don't think you need to change that.
If your
game,
stand is set up in a grove of white oaks, I don't see the point. But if your stand is set up with red oaks around it, maybe
now
we can make that very attractive.
Validity here.
Yeah, and I'm not just going to, you know, prioritize and understanding the research to then how can you apply it. Don't waste your time doing it on white oak grove because they're already attractive
enough. And don't do large swaths.
Go
small scale.
Don't hear that research and be going, oh, I'm not going to burn in the fall.
Because
doing a little 50-yard burn around your stand is simple.
That takes literally 20 minutes in a backpack
And don't
blower.
Be concerned about the pressure. I think so many times people get too concerned about the pressure or the disturbance. Well, if you're attracting deer to the area because of that disturbance, do it.
Well, here's a little bit of a side, because I'm 100% agreeing on that. We know, and I had a conversation with a gentleman yesterday on a piece of property in Kansas, showing him, and he hunts western Kansas. So we're talking grass, CRP, a ditch, but like...
A ditch with a hackberry and a cedar.
A hackberry and a cedar, right?
Yeah.
So like when they're hunting this 700-acre parcel, they see the whole thing. So essentially... What the conversation went was, he goes, Matt, I got to be honest with you. I don't feel that a lot of people are right when they try and discuss the pressure that we put on whitetails.
Yeah.
He goes, I've bumped deer. We spot and stalk a lot out there. And he goes, I will find individual bucks, and they're chasing a very specific one right now. He's like, I'll find them 80% of the time. And I've bumped them before. And guess what? I go back to the same place, and he's probably bedded 40 yards away from where he was bumped.
Yeah.
Now, granted, it's a grassland, and there's a lot of cover out there.
Yeah.
But that deer had been spooked, and everyone everywhere else wants to think, well, that deer's gone. He's off out of the county, or he's on the neighbor. I bumped him. This just changes the game. The home site fidelity of that deer knows that that's his home. That's where he's best suited to be at. That's what he knows. The absolute best.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're talking days and years.
Yeah.
They go back to the same spot. Boom. Deer stands up.
Like, yeah.
That's that right there. That thicket, that one plum thicket or that one deal, that 40-yard patch, that is where he's going to be at. The deer stands up after being bumped several days in a row.
China had this conversation where
I think we play into pressure way too much. I think we give too much credit to the animal. I think that mature deer are wiser than young ones.
Mm-hmm.
That's easy
but not
to
too
see.
Mature.
Right.
Not senile mature.
Yeah, exactly.
There's that middle ground.
But what I think it's at the end of the day, the deer just simply find the places that we're just not routinely bumping them, and that's where they're at all the time.
Yeah.
We're very patternable in what we do and how we access a property.
You're
going
to take the same road every time. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to take the same trail. Like, and I think deer learn that pretty quickly.
Very quickly.
Chad, I had that, you know, take it from a grassland and go into timber. And I feel like a lot of times people think that when you hunt big timber that because you go into a stand and there's deer sign and you hunt it and then – it's like they stop working those scrapes. They stop that you put the pressure on and they're no longer there.
No.
And how many times do you watch, like, Chad and I now have been blessed enough to get to hunt our family farm and the woodlands, now that we've got to lease for so many years, like, and we've been able to run cameras on the whole place for so long that we can watch a deer be very active in one site,
yeah,
and then leave it completely and spend 2 weeks, yep, two ridges over, and be there for 2 weeks, and all of a sudden
shift,
come back,
yep,
and we not even have hunted it.
Or
check the cameras now with the, right, Cuddy Link system, where it's just like we're just watching them just pack
doing
their suitcase and move two ridges over and never come up to that camera for 2 weeks.
And you never applied pressure to that area.
No pressure.
Just random
whatsoever.
Deer that you weren't chasing.
And we see it a lot, yeah, with like a doe group where it's like food plot, food plot, food plot, boom, gone. And they're, well, over on another one.
Right. But think about that for a second, because what have we just been talking about? How fragile and time sensitive
forages
are.
Exactly.
And when things shift and things change, or when this red oak starts dropping and they've depleted the white oaks in the forest,
yeah,
or they've spoiled, well, of course that's going to shift. But if,
yeah,
you're not in tune and you're not in sync with all that, and all you're doing is looking at cameras, you're going to think that spot's dead. And it could be, but,
yeah,
it's not because of the pressure that you put on it, because you hunted it the one time.
And it could be a persimmon started dropping up there.
Yeah.
Or whatever other soft mass may be up,
right,
there. And I think you don't think that 4-year-old doe doesn't know where the best food source is in that 400 acres. So,
she
of
knows.
Course, she's going to pack her bags.
And she knows where you're at,
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah,
or where,
so,
you're going to be at. The
so
most
it's like,
frequent,
well,
places
I
to encounter.
I can pop
you
over there, and I'm going to spend a week around that persimmon tree until that food source is gone.
Yep.
And then I know that red oak
over there
is going to be prime, and,
yep,
I'm going to go spend a week or two over there.
It's kind of like when you got a bunch of old cows,
mm-hmm,
in a field, and then you bring in new cows. Those old cows, they know where the water is, and they're,
yep,
teaching all the young. Like, that's exactly what happens every single year, every single fall, every single spring. These shift in patterns and where forage is and where it's not at, these fawns are learning that, and they're,
yep,
taking that same behavior that they were taught, or they just reacted to because they're following mama wherever she goes. They're doing the same stuff.
Yeah.
Same exact stuff.
Yeah. I felt like that whole fire and the preference, when you could almost line it up in as far as preference. Let's just skip the part I set on fire, but the preference of,
mm-hmm,
eight different species. And you could almost give, like, just for each species, give them 2 weeks. And you look at, and you just like, okay, this species A gets October, the first 2 weeks of October. This species gets the last 2 weeks of October. This species gets first 2 weeks of November. This species gets the last 2 weeks of November.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a couple others fall in there in the middle. And it's just like, wow, you can see the importance of diversity. And,
yeah,
that's,
yeah,
just the red oaks. That's
not
white oak, bur oak,
totally,
chinkapin oak.
But on top of that, we also, in the first study, just found out that even though they drop at that 2 week period, typically,
yeah,
they may not hit that until January 15th.
Yeah.
Based on all the other forage that you might be supplementing, or you may not be supplementing if your farm's not productive during that time of the year. But it just goes to show that dropping doesn't mean everything, and having this understanding of, I think, tonnage and forage, like, as a landowner, ask yourself, when does your food dry up?
Yeah.
Like, do you know when things get limited? Do you know what deer foraging on in January when you're not really watching your cameras anymore? Like,
yeah,
do you know what's happening out there? Because they certainly do.
Yeah.
And they're really in tune with it. Or they've completely just left the place because you haven't addressed that window and that,
yeah,
time frame from a foraging standpoint. So it was all very, very fascinating. But to me, we talked about this pre-show on this podcast, but – you know, as I'm going through and doing TSI on Elam Ridge, I went back and looked at, like, a historical image of the place. It was very different from what it looks like now. Like, very few trees, very scattered.
And that was back to the 1950?
1955. And as I'm cutting in there, it's very apparent to see that aerial image.
Yeah.
Come to life as you're on the ground with the chainsaw in your hand, because you're like, no, there's a bigger tree. There's a probably, you'd consider that a wolf tree, but everything in between it seems to be relatively junky. Yeah. There's a lot of persimmon mixed
when,
in.
When you go to that historical image, 35 acres, less than 100 trees, right around less than 200 trees.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
now you've got over 1,000?
Thousands.
So pretty drastic. And I think the first thing I told you when you sent it over, I said, whoa, and we wonder where the quail went.
You look at that place, you're like, that had quail.
Yeah.
That had quail. That's what you would want to have seen as a bird hunter.
And what happened? Well, the open space got turned into monoculture fescue.
Yeah, yep.
And the timber grew up to be too thick for a quail.
And we
scratch our heads and we blame it on predators or whatever, but it's like the landscape has changed so much. How many insects does a fescue attract versus native prairie? Thousands?
Weeds.
Different? how many herbaceous native plants could grow in the timber, which really wasn't timber. It was more savanna woodland-like.
Yep.
So pretty drastic.
Very
and so
drastic.
When you're running that chainsaw, you're running into young oaks and...
Some young oaks, a lot of elms, a lot of cedar. Honestly, there's a lot of cedar in there.
Yeah.
And dogwood species, persimmon, some cherry mixed in. Yeah. But generally, some post oak, but white, black and red. Black
in the Ozarks,
red.
It's pretty common to find what was once...
Mulberries, too.
Mulberry? Yeah. I'll say it, it's pretty common in the Ozarks to find what used to be open... to be now heavy in elm, cherry, and mulberry, these soft mass fruit. Like, I'm looking right here, Matt.
They're pioneering tree species.
I was looking right here, and I was like, man, what are all the birds? Like, what do they put? Mm-hmm. What seed is that?
Yep.
Oh, wait a second.
Yep.
Hackberry.
Exactly. Right there.
Right there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there was I don't know, dozens just right here on the fire pit or on our fire pit.
Well, here's taking that another step farther. It's like, okay, that was pretty much borderline savanna if it wasn't savanna.
Yeah.
And so that we know is great for songbirds, right? So they're foraging on all these species that have this soft mass dropping, depositing. So that fills in all the gaps, right?
Yeah.
And now we've got a forest full of these types of species that we talked about that birds are going to forage on a lot. Mulberry, persimmon, hackberries, elms, and what was the other one? Cherry. Cherry.
Yeah.
So we know that's going to probably be...
you can throw cedar in there because it's
cedar. Yeah, so there's a lot there. But what's crazy now is now... I can see that in the understory of some of these larger trees and in close proximity. So that's like first aggression post savanna. And now the fact that there's cedars growing, birds are roosting there and foraging in there. Guess what else is now directly underneath of those cedars?
Invasives.
Bush honeysuckle.
Bush honeysuckle, autumn olive.
Which is another berry. And so it's like, this is like a multi-step progression of how songbirds have been foraging on these soft mass species, depositing seed.
And not
no
just
disturbance.
That. What is,
and, oh, here
what
we
is
are.
The common roost tree for birds in the winter?
Absolutely.
Cedar. What is a species that has berries during the winter when they roost in cedar?
Hackberry.
Bush honeysuckle? Winter creeper?
Yep.
Oriental bittersweet?
Absolutely. There is absolutely, in my opinion, it is such a strong connection correlation there. That is a very large reason why.
I think of it like this. When I looked at your aerial, because mine wasn't that vastly different.
Right.
And the differences that were apparent in my farm, in my area, neighborhood, was man-made differences.
Right,
it wasn't natural disturbance different.
Yep.
Like yours. What was the main thing? Okay, so that was 1955 to, you know, we're roughly looking at 70 years in that difference. 70 years didn't change that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how long have we been here? How long has Earth been here? When did God put that? When did he make that? When were those days that he made that?
Yeah.
Like, and then now, you know, that's widely debated. You think about how much it's changed from then, and it take the 70 years from today to 1950s, then go 70 from 1950, go back to 1880.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How much had it changed?
Well, I don't think it changed as much. In my belief, it didn't change as much from, let's just say, 1700 to 1900, 200 years.
Yeah.
I bet it didn't change as much then as it has from 1955 to 2021, just due to urbanization, due to people moving in. And
I think it's,
number one thing, and I want to tie that in before you jump.
Disrupting.
The disturbance and the fire regime.
Yep.
There was way more fire that naturally occurred, set by Native Americans, pioneers, whoever set these fires. Fires got out. That's the number one thing, in my opinion, to fight back the overgrowth of berry species like bush honeysuckle, even eastern red cedar, hackberry, because none of those species can take fire like the oaks can.
And guess what?
And that's where it's just like, you could fix so much of this just by burning. Now, some of it's going to take some chainsaw work and then burning.
And that's absolutely what's happening. And I saw that picture, and I'm looking at it, and I'm like, okay, it was grazed underneath of like that savanna. But I'm looking at it and saying, that's my goal. Like, that's what I want. That's what I'm going to go in and just willy-nilly just cut and burn, and it's going to get back to that, because those trees are still there.
Yeah,
1950, that's only a 70-year-old tree. That's only 70 years since that picture. A lot of those trees are still there. Some have been harvested. I see stumps of some larger trees.
Yeah,
but there are still remnants of those exact same trees from that aerial, and I'm like, that's the goal that I'm shooting for. And it's going to take probably, you know, several fires and multiple thinnings to get there, but why not?
Yeah.
Why not get it back? And I'm going to be removing so many bad species and making way for good species. At the end of the day, it's going to be very, just because of the composition of what is growing there, it's going to be very heavy, hard and soft mast oriented. Not that I dislike or think that there's no place for other tree species, but based on what's there and the condition, that's pretty much what's going to be left.
Where would mulberry, hackberry, what was it, cherry, where would they grow? Where are we okay? In places that don't get burned regularly, riparian areas,
north slopes,
east slopes, coulees on those slopes where moisture is so abundant that a fire can't really damage them.
Correct.
That's where they were supposed to be. That's where they're very common.
But
they spread all over the hillside.
There's sycamores on west-facing slopes high on a ridge. It's like
I see it all the time. We found them on our glade when we were doing our glade resting. It's just like,
this is not your place, dude.
Yeah.
Get out of here. Yeah. So there's a lot of species that are just, it's not that we hate them or don't feel that there's value there. It's just, you're out of place. So at that point, you're gone.
Yeah.
Like, you're just, sorry.
Sorry,
you can't move yourself, so I'm going to move you. Get out of my way.
Yeah. No, and I think, you know, boy, we really went on a forestry rant there, but that's where that's, you know.
I think I had a
These
purpose.
Topics with Marcus Lashley, we're very just like, okay, you know, there's an importance there. There's a reason that we need to talk about the red oaks and that importance, because so much we've lusted after the white oak.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That now we're like, okay, let's tone it back and really kind of look big picture. And if that's one thing I could say to people that are listening to this podcast each and every week, is we're really just trying to get people to see big picture. It's not whitetail deer and targeting those. It's much bigger. And if you want to be really good at targeting the white-tailed deer, you need to think bigger picture.
You've been too narrow-focused for too long that you've missed the big picture. And so we got to go back to the big picture and all that information that you already learned from the narrow point of view. Once you have the big picture, apply it there, and you're going to kill the biggest deer.
Yep.
Like, don't worry about that. Just think big scale. But at the same time, Adam, big scale is pretty simple.
Yeah, it is.
It's a complex world, but we can boil it down to simple,
to
repeatable,
simplify it.
Intentional actions, and you're going to have results.
Yeah,
and that's what's encouraging, I think, and should be to everyone else out there listening and applying this stuff. So,
no doubt.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was good, and I know we're going to have him back on soon.
Totally.
Anyway, guys, hopefully you enjoyed this week's podcast. You probably now are aware that we just basically did two parts. We interviewed him, we had our discussion, and then now we broke it down once we stepped back and thought about it more and said, okay, how does this really apply to you as a landowner? So, anyway, guys, we appreciate it. We'll catch you next week.
See ya.